This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Aaron Wood Wortman share memories as a volunteer KBOO reporter in the 80s. If you have a story to share from KBOO's past, contact Lynn Fitch, 503-231-8032, extension 222, or navigator at kboo.org. This has been the Weekly Navigator Report. Thank you.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Yellow Pages, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New mobile applications available for iPhone and Android. For more information, you can visit pdxgyp.com.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This is KBOO Portland.
What we're going to do is throw a lot of banana peels around Chicago and have the machine stumble.
Although the beats were originally non-political, others who were political were really following the beat movement to its logical conclusion.
There's this myth that black people did not resist until Watts or until the Black Panther Party. It's just not true.
The Oglala Nation is at a crossroads that can change the course of history for Indian people all across the nation.
The other half of the women's liberation movement is the boys. And that man who is strong enough to be Geno, that is a new man.
The Stonewall Bar to me is a terrible place where something great happened.
For 45 years, KBOO has let the sun shine in across Cascadia's airwaves. Join us every month in 2013 for a new treasure from the KBOO archives.
The year was 1968. Mass demonstrations against the Vietnam War, flower children roaming up and down the West Coast, the assassination of Martin Luther King sparking riots in the streets. And on the banks of the Willamette River, a little radio station is born with a vision of providing the Portland area with a center of community. That little radio station has now been around for 45 years and is still going strong. To honor our 45th anniversary, each month, KBOO will broadcast the voices of KBOO volunteers, staff, and board members sharing stories of the last 45 years of community radio in Portland. Tonight, to kick off the series, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, we're honored to present interviews with Sharon Wood Wortman and Sandy Polishuk, who were part of the early days of KBOO's public affairs programming. I am joined in the studio by Sharon Wood Wortman, who was involved in KBOO back in the day. And Sharon, I wonder if you could talk about when you got started at KBOO and how you got started.
KBOO was kind of a gift from the universe. I was a freshman in college. I was 40-something. And I think I saw some clip somewhere that said that KBOO was looking for news interns. So Ross Reynolds, who was public affairs manager then.
What year was that?
Well, as close as I can figure that out was probably about 85. So I did the news internship, and I think I did a good job because about that time, Harriet Baskis, who was the station manager, asked me if I would be interested in hosting a new program that she had got grant funded, and they would pay me That was big with me because I was a brand new freelancer. And the program was called Between the Covers, Interviews with Northwest Authors.
You know, it's interesting that program is still on KBOO.
I know. I see that.
And we have a lot of authors come through town and get on Between the Covers to promote their book signings.
It was really great. I did the first interview. I had, you know, no rules or regulations. It just had to be relevant to Northwest literature. So that meant creative nonfiction, poetry, novels.
Do you remember any of the authors that you had on at that time?
Well, the first ones were recorded, and I loved meeting all the people I was meeting because I was new to literature as well. One very memorable interview was with Clyde Rice, who won the Western States Book Award for his memoir, A Heaven in the Eye, published, I think it was in 84 or 85, and Clyde was 81 years old. So I thought, wow, if Clyde can do that at 81, there's still hope for me. You know, I was in my 40s, so.
Wow.
So that really stuck in my mind, and getting to meet him and his wonderful wife. So, and there were lots of interviews. But then, I think, should I tell you about my last recorded interview?
Oh, sure. Let's hear about that.
Oh, my goodness.
And I guess you were recording on tape back then.
Yes, we were recording on tape. So I would take my tape recorder with me and then come back and cut tape with a little razor blade and get the programs on the air. So the last, the first live interview was sort of the end of my career with KBOO. Don't ask me the difference between live and recorded, but somehow it made a lot of difference. So I don't know how much time we have, but
no, let's hear it. So they had you doing recorded interviews for a while, and then you decided that you were ready to do something live.
Yes.
Or someone else decided for you.
Well, I think somebody else decided for me. I think it just, the format went along, and then all of a sudden they said, oh, let's just do these live in the studio. So I don't know what the decision was about that. And I didn't really think too much about it until I had to show up for that first live interview. And I did want to say before this, I had been out in Ken Kesey's field.
Yes, yes. And I want to hear that story.
Yes.
So let's hear about the live interview first,
and then
we'll get to the story of Ken Kesey, the merry prankster.
Yes. Let's see. A string of interviews followed Ken and Clyde, and then someone, I don't remember who, decided that Between the Covers would be going live. Okay. So fine with me, I thought. Live meant no more cutting tape. Live meant a sound engineer. That would be good. My only technical expertise was changing batteries and flashlights. I'm so not a technical person. So first with the new format was former poet laureate to Congress and the poet laureate of Oregon, none other than William Stafford, and his son, what I call poet junior, Kim Stafford. There we were, father and son and I, seated across from each other, headphones tweaked, voices sound checked, alerts issued regarding rattling paper, cue track playing, the engineer on the other side of the glass counting down the seconds with the fingers of one hand. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 1, 1. I opened my mouth, but no luck. I could feel my face flush, hands and knees shaking like an electric meat grinder packed too tight. It didn't help that the Staffords were staring at me, or that I could see the sound engineer waving his arms in large circles as if he could fill the dead air with the sound of whirring. So I did what any sensible novice radio show host with microphone fright, mid-panic attack, would do while dying live. I took off my headphones, stood up, and disappeared without closing the door. Then I ran down the hallway for the front door. I don't know how far I'd have gotten if Harriet Baskis hadn't caught me. She stood less than 5 feet tall, even with her curly hair air-blown dry. But when provoked, she assumed the personality of a bayonet. You get back in there. Do you hear me? Right now, I am not doing this interview. You are. Now go. And she followed me to make sure I didn't bolt. I sat down, the Staffords holding on to their pens as if I might reach out and grab them to use as weapons, and then thank the great ohm meter in the sky. Poet Senior opened up his latest book and started reading a long poem, long enough that by the time he finished, the icicles reaching up into my throat and my brain and down into my heart had melted enough. My voice had thawed.
Wow. You were reading your memoirs. Have you written some memoirs of your time at KBOO?
I did. I finally, when you guys called, I said, oh, it started me thinking about my time at KBOO, you know, all these many years ago now. And I thought, oh, I could write this stuff down. So I started writing it down.
Wow. And are people going to get to read that?
Well, I hope so. I don't know quite where yet, but we're always working on getting our work out there in the public.
Oh, yeah. Maybe we can have a section on the KBOO website of memoirs. So now let's talk a little bit about another story of your experience here at KBOO. Not necessarily running out from a live interview, but going and visiting Ken Kesey of the Merry Pranksters, people who might not be aware. These are the, I don't know, troublemakers of the early 60s, and went on a bus called Further. Ken Kesey then wrote One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and a well-known writer and prankster. So tell us about interviewing him.
Well, I had called, and I was able to set up an interview with him to drive down to his Pleasant Hill farm, down around Eugene. He actually had a farm down there. And I wanted somebody to go along to take photos, so I invited John Nance, who was the author of a book about a lost Philippine tribe called the Gentle Tasadai. And then a man I was dating at the time, who also happened to be the book reviewer at the Oregonian, because John was going along, he wanted to come along. So I'm sitting in the back seat of John's car. John's driving my little Datsun, was leaking oil again. This was very skimpy times. So I'm sitting in the back seat behind John and Paul Pinerich, feeling like I was going to the moon down I-5, because we're all going down to meet with Ken Kesey. So, of course, you know, I had seen Cuckoo's Nest, so that seemed like a pretty big deal to me. But remember, now I'm new to literature at this time, so I was pretty easily dazable. So when we got down there, here's what I remember. Ken wearing a three-piece suit. He has a feather in his hat that's very long, and he's riding his tractor. And I think there was a parrot or a cockatoo involved. I'm not sure which. But at the end of the interview that night, we were down there most of the day and it got dark. I remember sitting out on the Kesey back porch, listening to the crickets under a full moon. This was in August. Just so badly wanting the KBOO audience to see what I was hearing. It wasn't just I wanted them to hear it. I wanted them to see it.
And what vision did you have in mind then?
I don't know. What I mean, it's like the, you know, the crickets were serenading the moon. You know, you would get that, you know, on the Kesey farm, right? It was just, wasn't surreal, because, I mean, it was real. It was very real. So it just made an impression on me, partly who he was and we were there, and that I got to, you know, a gig like KBOO would have me entree into the farm. Mm. I felt very like it was a little bit of magic.
Tonight, we're talking about the early days of KBOO Public Affairs programming with Sharon Wood Wortman. Later in the hour, we'll be joined by Sandy Polishek. You're listening to a special program, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, 45 Years of KBOO History. This is a monthly series that will air throughout this, our 45th anniversary year. If you have a story to share about the early years of KBOO Community Radio, email navigator@kboo.org or go to the webpage kboo.fm/stories. We've been hearing from Sharon Wood Wortman about a road trip to Southern Oregon, and I'd like to play a clip of the interview with Ken Kesey at his farm there in 1985.
One of the great things about being famous is you get to talk to other famous people. So I've had Norman Mailer here, and I've had Arthur Miller here, and, mm-hmm. and I've had a chance to talk to Richard Hugo and people like that. And one of the things we always talk about is what happens to American writers? Why don't we get any better? And
there was something in Esquire, too, on that, wasn't there? In this last summer issue on reading you were quoting.
Yeah, that dumb thing in Esquire there.
But, yeah, I think so.
Right, yeah. But that idea you had, I mean, particularly following Cuckoo's Nest, I mean, you're talking about a boom-boom kind of effect there. It's very powerful. I've often wondered myself what that meant to you. I mean, to go to such resounding kinds of successes one after the other.
Well, I've never had any doubt as to who I was. That's never bothered me. Mm-hmm.
How would you describe yourself then?
Well, I'm not Shakespeare, but I'm better than Barry Manilow. I know where I exist, but that isn't it. It's what you ought to be.
And Who's ought?
Oh, my ought.
Yeah.
And then not only my ought, but there's bigger oughts than mine.
You talk about your twilight years. How old are you?
Oh, 79, 80, 80, I'm
one
same
more time.
Year. I know he's at least 82.
Does that mean you're not going to answer my question?
No, it means I'm talking about working talent. I'm talking about Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about when you can deliver a punch. Oh, I'm a professional. Yeah, I know what I'm doing. And I'm doing it as full out as I can all the time. I got the metal to the floor all the time.
I understood, too, you referred also to some other kind of power than your own, whether that comes through it in the writing. I mean, are you conscious of that when you're writing, that some of those words are just coming out, or are there?
Well, we're now talking about muse,
yeah.
The muses, and as Wendell Berry says, it comes from musing on something, from reflecting and
right.
thinking on something. And we went through a period of time in which we were being taken by the muse without having to reflect. Mm-hmm. It was moving us. I have a real sense of my talent. I know where I stand amongst people, and I know how good I am and how good I ought to be. And I'm not near as good as most great writers. And I ought to be better. And that rubs you somewhat. But when you're courting the muses and you really want to be touched by the moving spirits, you find that you can't do it in New York. And you can't do it in Hollywood. I find that even if I'm not writing, I'm closer to it out in that field than I am when I'm back in New York. Malcolm Cowley taught us something about writing, which has to do more than writing.
Mm.
It has to do with respect for writing and respect for people who have written.
Mm.
And whenever I do a writing seminar, the first thing I tell them is it's just as hard to write a bad novel as it is a good novel.
Mm-hmm.
And that you don't ever want to hurt anybody. Mm-hmm. And that when somebody publishes something good, every writer triumphs. Mm-hmm. And so it's not a competition. It's relatively easy to draw the spotlight. That's the thing that a lot of people don't understand. My dad used to say about me, he says, you can draw a crowd in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you do with the crowd once you've drawn them?
Right.
Can you tell them the truth? That's the thing. I mean, can you stand shoulder to shoulder with people that you respect through the ages? You know, the Bel Shem Tov of Hasidic literature. Or can you stand up there with Rimbaud? Can you stand up there with Faulkner? These are really our allies in an ongoing revolution fighting against a deadly thing in our nation today.
It's
growing fascism.
That was writer Ken Kesey, recorded by KABU volunteers at his Oregon farm in 1985. We're speaking with Sharon Wood Wortman, who was one of the volunteers who took that road trip in an old Subaru with three male colleagues back in 85. Now, Sharon, we just played a clip of the interview, but if you listen to the whole thing, you hear a lot of men's voices. You yourself hardly got a word in. Do you feel like you were edged out a little bit by your male counterparts?
Yes. Yes. I think I was edged out. But I thought, I think that was part of what I was doing with this interview as well. I didn't know that much about Kesey. I mean, I fell in love with the movie, okay, not the literature. And I don't think I'd even read Sometimes a Great Notion, which a lot of people thought was really, you know, his better book. So I was there to facilitate and arrange it for KBOO. And it was a little bit like, what would you call it, a good old boys sitting around the campfire. And I thought that Paul Pinnerich, who had interviewed many writers, and maybe not John Nance so much, they really wanted to know where Kesey was going with his writing. Demon Box had just come out. And so the question was, are you ever going to be as great as you were? I mean, they don't come out and ask that, but that's the thing. So what is this book, and is it as good as you were before? So I think in the interview, Kesey talks about where he is, what he called his gonzo, which was his big personality. He was a performer, a director. And later on, the feeling I got was that, you know, creating long novels was not what he wanted to do anymore. I think he said it in his own words about 19 minutes in. He says, I'm moving off the page and back to people and the campfire. So I think he was all right with that, but it felt like he did a lot of defending in this interview.
Mm. Now, Pinnerich at the time was the book critic at The Oregonian.
Yes, and the poetry editor. And so he'd read, you know, and he was also, you know, a would-be novelist himself, always frustrated novelist, I would say. Didn't know so much at the time, but that's what it turned out to be. So the question was, if you have all this talent, Kesey, Mr. Kesey, why are you not doing this thing that you do so well? So that's what I thought the interview was about.
Now, at that time, it was the mid-80s. They were in the midst of the backlash on the women's movement. I mean, do you see the role of these men as kind of playing into the anti-feminism of the times at all?
I think they were. I'm not speaking for John Nance. I'm speaking for Paul and Ken. I think that they didn't even get it at all. I think it was, you know, just such a foreign idea to them. At one point in the interview, Ken says, well, really, civilization's about whether, you know, you're sitting around, he's talking about cave days, whether the woman in the next cave, who had the most beautiful woman. Oh, really? Okay. So, I mean, that's...
Yeah, and he also got a lot of flack for homophobia.
Yeah, that didn't come up in this interview. But really, nothing would surprise me about Ken Kesey. You know, nothing very much. I don't think he was... I think he was a Southern Willamette Valley farm boy. Don't ask me, you know, how this other stuff happened, so... You know, if he hadn't...
It was acid, right? It was LSD.
Yeah, I think that's what they call that stuff. Yeah, I remember when he passed and I realized that, you know, his problem was his liver, but it wasn't alcohol in his liver. It was the LSD in his liver.
So he broke out of certain stereotypes or, I guess, prejudices, but kept some others.
He did. Well, you know, that's why they call us human beings. There's just no perfection out there, right?
Well, except for KBOO.
Of course. Well, that's a given. That's a given.
And how did your involvement in KBOO impact your life?
Well, it certainly, after I had that whole thing about the stage fright, it took me a few years to figure this out, but... Or I call it stage fright. It was actually mic fright. Because before, I would just have this little tape recorder and there'd be a little microphone on the table or whatever. But in the studio with this big honking microphone in front of your face and then you got these earphones on, I don't know what happened that day. But I literally, it was just such a feeling like, okay, I'm going to die here. So you better go outside where you get fresh air while you're dying. And later on, I came to believe that really was a significant indication of how I felt about myself. I hate that jargony word, self-esteem, but it certainly played into it with me because, you know, did I deserve to be heard without my voice edited? I mean, that's what it came down for me later. And at the time, people said, oh, go take an acting class. No, that'll get you out of yourself. Go do impromptu. That will help. And somebody else said, oh, when you're in the audience, just imagine all those people out there are naked. Now, that's really going to help, too. So I did all these things. But not until, I mean, KBOO was the catalyst for this. Not until I began leading bridge walks for school groups. You know, I took 20,000 people bridge walking between 1991 and 2010 when I retired from bridge walks to work on this kid's book I'm working on, but we won't talk about that. But talking to 60 third graders at a time on the sidewalks of Portland really cured me of any kind of inability to speak to people anywhere. So KBOO made me aware of it, and the third graders kind of cured me.
I guess they would. And we don't get to hear what the subject of the children's book is?
Oh, yeah. What else? Bridges. Yeah, bridges have been taught as part of Portland Public Schools' third grade social studies curriculum since the 1950s, and there's never been a book just for kids. So I had the brainy idea a couple years ago that maybe we needed to do that. So my husband and I have been the volunteers on the project. Lots of people on it. Our goal is to give 4,000 free copies to Portland Public and Vancouver School District. So we're really busy on that.
Wow. Any other stories about KBOO that you want to share?
Oh, I just appreciate KBOO. I didn't realize, you know, I was so unaware when I first came here that I didn't even know there were three kinds of radio. I hate to admit that. Just a moment. There's commercial radio, and there's public radio, and then there's community radio. You know, I just knew it was KBOO, and that if I went to 90.7, maybe I'd find some, you know, old rock and roll music, which is what I grew up on. So, you know, as I came to be here and saw what everybody was doing with their volunteer hours and how it was all listener supported, what an incredible gift is KBOO. I mean, for all of us, really.
Well, what do you think community radio, I mean, what does it mean to you?
Well, what did I see? I think I read the definition that community radio is 10% radio and 90% community. So that means the community puts together, it's about the community. You're going to get here what you don't get on any other radio station. You know, we're not talking about advertising or hearing what we hear, and people that are underrepresented, they will be here at KBOO.
Yeah, and I guess it's not just what goes out on the air.
No, it's a family inside this door as well. It's amazing to me. Kind of reminds me of, I don't know if I can make this analogy, but reminds me of 12-step programs who work for some reason that's sort of mysterious. And KBOO's like that. You know, there's something spiritual about this place. It just keeps going. I think the KBOO experience indirectly led to my last two big sort of public performances. One was I did a one-woman show at Portland Shoebox Theater. That told me that maybe I'd rewired my self-esteem somewhere along the line. But one of the huge things was in 2010, I told my what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now story on the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall stage before 2,500 people. 17 minutes without notes. Yeah. And I didn't use Valium or...
No running away from the microphone.
No running away from the microphone. That was for the Moth Radio Hour when they were in Portland.
We've been speaking with former KBOO volunteer Sharon Wood Wortman, speaking about the early days of KBOO public affairs programming. This is a special program. Tune in, turn on, and remember 45 years of KBOO history. A monthly series that will air throughout the year of 2013, our 45th anniversary year. If you have a story to share about the early years of KBOO Community Radio, email navigator@kboo.org or go to the webpage kbu.fm/stories. Coming up next, we'll hear from Sandy Polishak, who was a volunteer and board member in the late 70s and early 80s. She talks about when she first started listening to KBOO during the student takeover of Portland State University in 1970. We also have some archive footage of that student takeover. We are joined in the studio now by Sandy Polishak, who is a former KBOO volunteer, board member, and involved with the station in the early 80s and late 70s. And I wonder, Sandy, if you can talk about some of the people around KBOO at that time. I've heard a lot about Harriet Baskus.
Absolutely. Yeah. Harriet came to Portland in the fall of 80, and I think she came with her boyfriend, got the job as Ross Reynolds as the program director, I think. And I don't think initially she was even on staff, but yes, she ended up as the station manager.
And at that time, what was the city of Portland like? What were some of the issues?
I remember a little later, I remember interviewing a man from a human rights group in El Salvador. There were all these wars going down. I remember when I interviewed this man, he was documenting the people who were killed. They would take photos of the bodies that were found so that the families could come and look through the photographs and see if they find their children. And they were, of course, the government was harassing them. And I mean, I'm interviewing him and I'm thinking, my God, this is such dangerous work he's doing. And I said that, and it was, you know, I felt like I was talking to a saint. He said, we don't think about that. This is work that has to be done, or something to that effect. Yeah, it was very amazing people that came through then. So that was one of the big things was El Salvador.
And that was during the Reagan era. Because I know Reagan was
right.
You know, challenged for his support of the El Salvadorian government when they were killing all of the
And then you the had people. Locally, there were a lot of things around nuclear power going on and a lot of those things. I also remember the first time we did election coverage with our news department, and that was, you know, challenging and fun, and a lot of people getting involved. And
you remember whose election was it?
No, I remember that Ross Reynolds was the news director, and
it might have been Reagan's second term.
it was probably Reagan's second term. But it was also we were also covering local elections,
right?
You know that we had people stationed down at the county and stuff to call in with returns, and you have to remember that before the internet, news coverage, news reporting was a very different system.
Right, you didn't even have cell phones.
No, oh golly, no.
So how did you manage?
Dial phones.
And
or
then you
people come physically.
Come running back and forth.
I guess so, yeah.
I mean, go out with a tape recorder and get something on tape and run it back.
I can remember in 1984, we sent a team down. The Democratic Convention was in San Francisco, and we sent a team down, and I went with that. And I can remember here, you know, in the reporters, it was great to have a press pass at the one person I really remember meeting at that convention. There were great places for food that, like, I think AT&T had this wonderful lounge with all the shrimp you could eat. And I remember meeting Chris Hedges there, who was with the New York Times, I think, at the time. But I also remember some of these big reporters like that, seeing them on payphones, dictating their stories over the phone back to, you know, because they didn't have laptops, they didn't have cell phones, they didn't have email. So it was the old-fashioned way.
For me, you know, I consider radio to be an organizing tool, not just a way of sharing information, but a way of helping people in a community get organized on issues.
You bet. Yeah.
And hopefully that's what we're doing and we'll continue to do for another 45 years.
Yeah.
Here at KBOO.
Is
at
it
least.
45 now?
45. That's this year.
When KBOO started, I lived in Northwest and I lived kind of up in the lower part of the hills, and we really didn't get very good reception. But I remember during the Portland State student,
protests and uprising?
Yeah, they had occupied the park blocks, and then the police came in and smashed heads. They had tents. It was so much like Occupy, except it was much, much, much shorter. But I can remember I had three little babies, and I remember being home listening to that. It was pretty staticky on KBOO where I lived back then. You were lower power, and I was in the hills. But I can remember that lifeline of being able to get that report because I knew it was going on. There was no way I could be down there with my little kids. And I remember that was the first time I managed to get the station and really listen to something. You know, we didn't have a news department, but when something like that happened, KBOO did news.
And do you remember what that student occupation was about?
It was anti-war. It followed the Kent State and Jackson State student deaths. It was a student strike is what it was. That's what the word I was looking for. And they walked out of classes. They shut down the school and they put up tents in the park blocks by Portland State. And I don't know how many days that went on, but it was a very big event. You can still go down to Portland State and see there's a display on the history that has a little bit on that in the, I think it's called the Browsing Room in the second floor of Smith Center. Very interesting photos. And there's been a lot of, there've been theses written on it and stuff. But, and I imagine Mike Monk's book has stuff on it, I hope. But,
and that's the red.
Yeah, the red guy. Maybe it does. I'm not sure. But it was a very big event in and that was all sparked by, I believe, the bombing in Cambodia. So it was all part of the war in Southeast Asia protests.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with former KBOO volunteer Sandy Polishuk. We do have some of the audio recorded by KBOO volunteers during the 1970 student uprising at Portland State University when students took over the administration buildings to call for an end to the Vietnam War and the war in Southeast Asia. This reporter is following a student march through downtown Portland. The protest marches through Meyer and Frank department store, and this particular section starts with the chant, "Free Bobby, Jail Nixon," a reference to Bobby Seale, the founder of the Black Panther Party, who was in prison for inciting a riot at the 1968 Chicago Republican Convention.
Free Bobby, Jail Nixon! Free Bobby!
There are shouts that they should go into Meyer and Frank. They've passed the Pioneer Post Office without stopping. Some people are leaving the street. And I think they are going to go into Meyer and Frank.
Everybody see us on the
clock says 13 minutes after 12 noon, and the crowd has entered Meyer and Frank.
1, 2, 3, 4, victory.
Marching past the information booth.
5, 6, 7, 8, organized and united states. 1, 2, 3, 4, victory to the people. 5, 6, 7, 8.
And it looked for a moment as if they'd go out the Fifth Avenue door, but now they're going to march around the store. Now they're marching again, they're moving.
Okay, well, the way out's there, not into a post.
This way. The door's right there.
Freedom of
you
the
and
press.
Your reporters
are...
The store officer has sent myself and a TV cameraman allegedly out the door, although it doesn't look like either one of us is going to go.
1, 2, 3, 4.
The crowd came back out of Meyer and Frank.
5, 6, 7, 8. Organize the matters of faith.
We're moving back into the street at the corner of Fifth and Morrison. Heading back up towards the area of Portland State University. Fewer people than started the march are gathered now in the middle of the street on Southwest Fifth Avenue by the Pioneer Post Office. And they've stopped. Some people are sitting on the pavement. The Channel 6 news car has pulled up in the back of the crowd. And one of the leaders of the march is calling for the people to go back up to Broadway and then march back to Portland State. But there are several people, in fact the bulk of the crowd isn't going to leave. Not just now. There are about 20 people sitting in the pavement in front of the Pioneer Post Office.
This is a recording from a protest in 1970 recorded by a KBOO volunteer. The march ended with a takeover of buildings at Portland State University and students setting up tents in the South Park blocks to establish an encampment to call for an end to the Vietnam War. We're going to play a bit more of that footage, including this interview with one of the protesters.
They're marching up the steps from Fifth Avenue to the Pioneer Courthouse grounds.
The thing that disturbs me about this demonstration is it ends up with the usual kind of extreme radical element which wants to bring in every other issue that is bothering their minds. And really the issue should be today the American, you know, invasion of Cambodia. And by bringing in Bobby Seale and going to Georgia Pacific, which as far as I know, it may be, you know, contributing to our environment problems, but I don't know that it has any role in the Southeast Asian war particularly. It seems to me these are irrelevant to, you know, the core of today's demonstration. And many people here seem to be determined to try to antagonize this silent majority. And the silent majority in America, which is saying yes to almost anything the president asks them to say yes to, still happens to have the economic power. And these people, I think, are misguided by trying to antagonize them rather than trying to prick their conscience and win some of them over. The fact that, you know, that you can't get a just peace by winning an unjust war. The fact that we're moving in, you know, to countries without even the express, let alone the real desire of the people for us to do that. This is the issue. And these people just drive off the very people who have the power and who, if they were with them, could get a change in our policies in the world today.
Can you give me your name?
My name? Yeah, it's Carl Schnorr.
Are you with an organization?
No, I'm not with any organization. I came here today because I'm very, very disturbed about President Nixon's decision to expand the war and about the hypocrisy involved. I'm very disturbed also by him holding up as, you know, virtues, the fact that we are wealthy and powerful. These are not, for sure, these are not Christian virtues, and these are not, you know, the ideals on which this nation was founded. And the fact that we're, you know, we're the blind leading the blind down a path of destruction, either through war or through population or through pollution or something, this to me is the real issue and the crux of the matter. And to talk about Bobby Seale, however just or unjust his cause may be, is in fact driving off our potential support from the more influential segment of our society.
They're moving off again.
Yeah, they're moving off.
The United Farm Workers Organization flags in front. Some people are still staying. Maybe up to 50 people are still sitting on the lawn in front of the Pioneer Courthouse. The others are moving up the sidewalk.
The strike plans at Portland State were being made, initially at least, by moderates. Lynn Stone told me he was organizing to prevent violence by giving students a nonviolent way to express their feelings. The Kent State deaths caused strike plans to be moved ahead. The organizers generally, not all of them, wanted Gregory Wolfe, the president of Portland State, to shut down the school. Wolfe had a discussion in his office with them. That was Tuesday. The discussion demonstrated that Wolfe could fight back any argument for closure. He had help from a faculty member whose name I do not know. And he was the bad guy. He was very strong against the idea of closure. Wolfe was the good guy. He was very sympathetic, but he was committed to keeping the school open all the same. But that night, Wolfe issued a statement through the wire services that he had changed his mind and the school was going to be shut down Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Barricades were being put up that night, and the area was sealed. There were incidents at the barricades. There were individuals like the people who We're living across from the school in Ione Plaza, which is a fairly plush sort of apartment house. And they didn't want to have to drive around the block to get to their underground parking lot, but finally they were convinced the barricades weren't going to come down just for them. The strike had 4 points: Cambodia, nerve gas, the trial of Bobby Seale, and the Kent State killings. And while the weather was good, groups went out twice. Large numbers of people blocked downtown streets. There was a demonstration at the induction center. The climax of the strike was to have been Friday. A march was scheduled from the park blocks to Washington Park for a giant memorial service at noon. And it was supposed to have 10,000 people at it. And the rain came, and everything was canceled. And the carnival was over. A couple of hundred people went to a memorial service at Old Main. A black speaker told them they were racists because they weren't concerned with all the black people who were dead. But four white middle-class students, got memorial services. And a Rabbi Rose talked, and it was a little hard for me anyway to tell what he was saying. He spoke clearly enough, but it was just hard to tell what he was saying. He was talking about attitudes toward death. Now, through the week, the Portland cops had been pretty cool in general. Wednesday, a few tax squad cops got trapped by a couple of hundred people on a corner by the Greyhound bus depot, and they tried to hit a few people, and they had some rocks thrown at them. And earlier, that same day, when the crowd had left the induction center, there were people who were left sitting on the pavement, and I'm told that most of them were people from Reed College, and there were several people arrested, but they weren't arrested until after the crowd was gone. On Thursday, the tax squad was waiting around the corner from the Safeway parking lot between 10th and 11th on Jefferson, after a lot of people had gone out marching around the area around the stadium freeway, basically west of Portland State. There were 500 or 600 people there in the parking lot, and the tax squad was out with clubs and helmets and the whole thing, waiting just around the corner. But when everybody started going back to the park blocks, they got back into their trucks and they went away. So the cops stayed calm.
That was a recording from the KBOO News Department in 1970, when students took over buildings and camped out in the South Park blocks for several days in May of 1970, before police cracked down on the encampment with violence. Sandy Polishak, a former KBOO volunteer, said the 1970 student takeover was a lot like the Occupy Wall Street encampments of 2011.
It's kind of astounding to me today how, yeah, people say we shouldn't be at war, but how little it affects our lives. Back then, in the early 70s, the late 60s, our lives revolved around the war. And I think one of the big differences was that we had a draft. And it was a brilliant move on the part of the government to get rid of the draft, because the students, the young people, the middle class, are no longer concerned the way they were then. It wasn't them going. And it's very sad to me today that we're living with this war without really living with it, most of us. And that those who are living with it are bearing such a disproportionate burden from it. It's terrible. At that time, it was terrible for everybody on some level, and we were all living it, and we were all involved. And I'm not advocating that. I would advocate no war.
Right.
But if you're going to have a war, the majority should not be getting off scot-free the way we are today. And because we weren't then, we had a very strong movement. This Centenary Wilbur Church, which was right over here, that big yellow building on 9th and Ash, that was the center of the anti-war movement. So it was right here in the neighborhood. Of course, it was before KBOO was here, but But everything was there. There was a GI coffee house. There was an alternative school. There was an alternative newspaper. We had the resistance potluck there every week. There was everything happened in this one place. It'd be wonderful to have a place like that again.
Mm. Well, so what made you come and volunteer after listening? And
I had a lot of friends that were involved with KABU. A lot of the women in the Women Collective were my closest friends. And my life had really changed. I'd gotten divorced and things were, I looked around. I knew I needed to start doing some different things. And this just seemed logical. I knew so many people here and it was an exciting place. And I also, not right away, but around, I think around 1980, I decided that I wanted to learn how to be an interviewer. And so that was something that, this was a place where I could get experience doing that. I still remember my first live interview and how terrifying it was. It was with a performance artist who I admired greatly. I don't even remember if it went well. I just remember how frightening it was that it was live. It wasn't, it'd be one thing to tape. My first piece that I produced was with the Shadow Project. I think it was in 1979.
What's the Shadow Project?
The Shadow Project is something that gets done sometimes around Hiroshima Day, because in Hiroshima, there were people who were vaporized, and all that was left was this mark on the sidewalk that looked like a shadow. And in fact, this year, the Physicians for Social Responsibility were doing chalk shadows around town. But this year, there was, in 79, Donna Slepak headed this up, I think, she did a whole thing. I think it was the first time it had happened here, and it was happening around the world. And she did something in the park blocks. I don't remember, but I remember doing a piece on it and interviewing her and going and interviewing the people there. And then, as I mentioned before we came on the air, that it was in the era of real tape, not digital, and you sat down with a razor blade and the tape and you spliced tape together, and that was how I did that piece. I really enjoyed going out and doing pieces. I like to go to art gallery openings and stick my mic in people's face and ask them what they thought about the art and produce little pieces like that. One of the things about having a microphone in your hand, you can be really pushy and you know, it's the opposite of shyness. Even if you normally wouldn't walk up to strangers and start talking, you've got this mic in your hand and it's permission. You just go up and you say, I'm with KABU, I'm doing a piece. And you talk to me, tell me what you think about this, and people talk to you.
Wow.
I also remember doing a piece with the people that would demonstrate in front of abortion clinics. And that was another real opportunity, because those aren't people I normally talk to. And I could go up and talk to them, and I didn't have to tell them what my belief was, whether I approved of what they were doing or not. I could just listen to them, and 'cause they deserve to have their piece on the radio, too. I believe in the free marketplace of ideas. And it was one reason I never got arrested, was during the South Africa apartheid. That was going on, too, and people were sitting in. We had, I don't think it wasn't a consulate, but we had some sort of, I guess it was a consulate. And he was probably honorary, but there was an office that people had sit-ins and got arrested at. And I can remember being there as a reporter covering that.
Thank you, Sandy Polishak, former KABU volunteer and board member. You've been listening to a special program, Tune In, Turn On, and Remember, 45 Years of KABU History, a monthly series that will air throughout the year through 2013, our 45th anniversary year here at KABU Community Radio. If you have a story to share about the early years of KABU Community Radio, email navigator at kbu.org or go to the website kbu.fm/stories. For KBU Radio, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
For 45 years, KBU has let the sun shine in across Cascadia's airwaves. Join us every month in 2013 for a new treasure from the KBU archives.
Tune in Tuesday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. The Melting Pot, featuring DJs, producers, and electronic artists from around the globe. Win tickets and stay up on events each and every Tuesday from 8 to 10 p.m. on The Melting Pot, right here at 90.7 FM KBOO.
It's a new year, and Black History Month is now upon us to reflect the issues unique to Black African peoples. Join me, Sequoyna Wright, a KBU volunteer regular, every Wednesday night at 7 p.m. for the month of February, starting February 2nd, as I discuss with special guests Tariq Nasheed, Dr. Umar Johnson, Dr. Claude Anderson, and my very own father about the present state of Black America. Topics include love and relationships, mental health, music, and economics. Tune in and join in on the conversation on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Good evening. It is 7:02 here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. And coming up in this hour is Hard Knock Radio. Stay tuned.
Yo, this is Ice Cube coming straight from a...